This edition of Culture was first broadcast on the 23rd of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 41st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, there's a party starting in London this week, you might have heard. They were sieving the pebbles out of the builder's sand for the beach volleyball on Horse Guards Parade this morning and making sure the sugar lumps in Greenwich tea rooms contain nothing illegally energetic ahead of the equestrian events down near the Meridian. So what has more rings than Bilbo Baggins but fewer than Liz Taylor used at wedding ceremonies? If you just found yourself mouthing the words, the Olympics, to that last riddle, you'll be right. We're saving the sportiness for next week, though, and instead concentrating on the artistic sideshows to the main Olympic event. We'll board a bus to inspect some Olympic-allied East End art, brought to you courtesy of Frieze.
It's a beautiful thing. It has these huge resin pieces which emulate a kind of an abacus look, and it's very climb-honourable. So it's really fantastic.
We'll invite you to listen to Ian Sinclair and Andrew Cotting, the men behind the elegant and elegiac film Swandown, a softly anti-Olympic thing, perhaps.
You know, Ian Sinclair's obsessed with the Olympics.
Yeah.
He hates the Olympics more than anything.
I read that in his...
He doesn't think anything should be allowed to happen in Hackney without his permission. So this is what this is about, I think.
We'll also enjoy a stirring multi-stereo Midori House session courtesy of London electro-rock pioneers post-war years.
Primarily, rhythm's always been a bit of an obsession of ours, I think. We're quite fortunate in having Fred as a drummer, because the man's a robot.
Plus, because you've been so good, a peep at Columbia's hit TV show based on the life and legacy of drug dealer extraordinaire Pablo Escobar, and the return of our possibly slightly overlooked 1 minute of sound. That's all here on Culture, with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We'll settle ourselves into the flow of this Culture show with some music. This is new from post-war years. It's the title track from their new EP, Glasshouse.
Cancel out by the other.
That was Post-War Years playing Glasshouse for us, for you, for everyone, live from their Midori House session here at Midori House last week. We'll hear more from them, plus a chat with the boys themselves a little later in the show. Now for the first part of a couple of artistic responses to the Olympics. The East End of London, the furthest reaches of which house the Olympic Park, have been synonymous with the capital's energetic, imaginative, possibly world-beating contemporary art scene over the last 20 years. Now, most of the works made in these former warehouses, smokeries and factories get exhibited further west and sold even further afield. So an agency dedicated to getting the people that live and work near supposedly artistic places to profit from it, called Create, teamed up with Frieze, the art magazine that became an art fair, that became three art fairs, that became London's art brand. And they gave five artists a chance to make some new work and show it out east, mostly in spitting distance of that hulking Olympic amusement park. Ah yes, that's the sound of the Frieze bus idling outside the art magazine's Arnold Circus HQ. Out east. But the nice east, not the far east, where the Frieze Foundation's projects have been installed. That's what the bus is for. We're going on tour. We're going on a school trip. First stop is Poplar Baths in Hackney, a grand Victorian thing that aspired to its Roman roots, refurbed and art decoified in the 1930s as a sport and health complex, and shut down in the 1980s. Anthea Hamilton and Nicholas Byrne have turned the cavernous main space into a gallery for their gigantic inflatable sculptures. There's Bitty Boo blown up to the proportions of the Attack of the 60-foot Woman. There's Robert Indiana's Love as a bouncy castle. Sarah McCrory is the curator of Frieze Projects and was our tour guide for the day too. I had a chat with her under a mural in the entrance of Poplar Baths.
The whole commissioning process for the Olympics has been, I think it's really interesting and really complex in that there are things that have been foisted upon people and there are things that, you know, people are very happy to have. But for Frieze, it was important to do what we always do, which is produce art projects at a certain standard, but also to do it in a way which is, I mean, either in keeping with the community or has, you know, some of the projects we've had consultations with them. And then some of them actually, like this project, it's just open, it's free. And people who live across the road in the blocks, you know, who are adults, have never been in this building, yet they walk past it every day of their lives. So it's a kind of a gesture towards that. Of course, artists using spaces in East London, what the Olympics has done is brought a lot of money in to help certain artist communities and also force some out, which was to be expected. Hackney Wicks Fish Island has done fairly well out of it, but also there are other buildings which have been taken over for other uses, which did.
So it wasn't just allotments that got dug up when they built the Olympic Park, right?
No, I mean, I think a lot of people have been displaced, and it will be interesting to see what happens in the fallout, in the aftermath. I mean, I hope, you know, one of the kind of, I was going to use the word legacy then, I was slightly avoiding it because it's been so overused for the Olympics, but hopefully the legacy of this space is that Tower Hamlets can go on to rent it and use it and hopefully raise money for its renovation eventually. I mean, the features in it, so you can see this kind of amazing tiling, original tiling. There's a mural.
It's amazing, there's a mural on the ceiling, sort of.
It's a sort of four points of perspective mural, and I think the muralist still lives in East London. And
it's sort of something like, it's a bit like if Stanley Spencer's channeling kind of like, yeah, Glengarry Glen Ross or something.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, it's quite, I'm not really sure what's happening. A guy in a bath with someone drinking a glass of wine next to him. There are some interesting parts of it. But overall, the whole building is, there are just some really beautiful elements of it. And if they can renovate that, that would, and we even had a kickstart in making people notice the building again, then that's a good thing.
And maybe before we jump back on the bus,
yeah,
you can tell us about another couple of the things you're going to pootle around and see this morning.
Yeah, we're going to go and see Gary Webb's playground. Gary is a fairly formal sculptor. He is a sculptor. He has a real interest in materials and form. And we asked him to make something which would be able to be climbed on. And so we've been working with playground engineers.
Did you make a face when you asked him that?
No, I did preface it with, I'm going to ask you, but if you, you know, don't hate me, if you find it really offensive, just say.
Everyone's favourite email starts with, don't hate me, but.
But the thing about Gary is, the thing he's really excited about is the challenge of materials and how you can push materials. And, you know, he's quite old school in that way, even though his work is very bright and feels very kind of contemporary. It also has that aspect of, you know, he loves to talk about, you know, the conversation we had about powder coating, and he's found this new kind of paint which is graffiti proof, and, you know, he's really kind of pushing materials in a very practical way. But then, I mean, when you see it, I couldn't be happier with it. It's a beautiful thing. It has these huge resin pieces which emulate a kind of an abacus look, and it's very climb honourable. So it's really fantastic. And then I guess we're going to see Klaus Weber's sand fountain later, which is in a warehouse which will be torn down soon as part of redevelopment. I think it's going to be flats. It's a really beautiful old warehouse, you know, the sort that, you know, creative people like us kind of slightly fetishize turning into a huge open plan living space. But no, it's brilliant building. And
A living room so large you can have a bath one end of it and no one can see.
Yes, that kind. And he's placed the sand fountain in the middle, and it's a traditional kind of off the peg fountain with the usual decorative, patterns which don't really adhere to any age or time, but it actually very slowly and gently propels sand out of it rather than water. He's made a series of fountains, and he said this will be his last one. But it's kind of an amazing piece. It's much slower, it's much more contemplative than maybe the kind of the literal bounce of Anthea and Nick's, but I think it's pretty good.
Next stop was Charlton Park in southeast London, a great green expanse of public grass and British summertime's best wet and windy weather. Gary Webb is a sculptor best known for a playful use of materials, unexpected turnouts for things that might seem familiar, and for this, he made a sculpture that's also a children's playground. Gary shouted eloquently through the wind about his work, titled Squeaky Clean, and some of the problems he had to overcome with building it in the first place.
The resin was quite difficult with the kind of colouring and getting all this kind of correct, and getting the sort of transparency to the resin as well, and without any of the kind of bubbles in it. Just a general sort of manufacturing sort of time and sort of speed. I mean, there's some tweaking to do, you know, just from the sort of safety side of it. But generally, it kind of came together quite well.
Has it been as fun to make as it is to look at?
Yeah, it was fun. I think it was just sheerly, like, kind of, you know, the compression of time was really more the thing. And all the different elements as well that was kind of sort of trying to make it all happen was the thing. And obviously, you know, bits going wrong and the weather. I mean, can you believe what? I mean, driving rain every single day we seem to have been in here. We were just kind of, you know, there was days I'd come home and even the baby would look at me and would just be like, Diddy, you know, and I'm kind of like just shivering with this kind of madness of this weather kind of beating us. But I mean, what a summer to put something like this in.
Next, we trundled up to the environs of the Olympic Park itself, in a weird hinterland of construction, optimistic projection put upon those flash new buildings, and some stubborn, scruffy old East London elements, sore thumbing their noses at the rest. Klaus Weber made a sand fountain and put it in an old warehouse. Outside, I spoke to Adrian Garrard, director of Create, the agency that commissioned Frieze to put on this show in the first place. Adrian, we're all here on this bus trip because of you. We're here. We're standing outside. It's a building site. It's a kind of cavern with Klaus's sand fountain inside it. But where did it come from, the idea to be doing stuff in East London while the Olympics are going on? It's not just what Create does, is it?
No, it's not. But I mean, East London, we exist because East London's Europe's largest cultural quarter. So there's 13,000 artists living and working here. There's over 120 galleries. But if you live in East London, you're much less likely to go to a gallery or, in fact, get a book out from a library or do anything remotely cultural. So all of our projects, and this is a good example of it, about bringing projects and art out of galleries and into funny places and into places that you wouldn't expect it.
So there's a kind of idea of putting, the unlikelihood of finding something like a kind of piece of conceptual art, contemporary art, in a place that's sort of halfway kind of cheek by jowl with the Olympic Park and various building sites around the place as well.
I think it's about persuading artists and organisations to actually look out their windows a bit and to get galleries to meet their neighbours. And there's really interesting communities and they're changing really rapidly, and I think that's part of the reason that artists like being in places like this, and because it is always changing, it is interesting, there are lots of surprises, but there aren't that many projects that actually involve young people. And so what we try and do is to get projects happening that don't have a kind of workshop program on the side of them, but actually are interactive. So Gary Webb's project is something you can climb on and your kids can. You wouldn't really know or care that it's an artwork, perhaps, but it's still a beautiful thing and it's a great experience. So all of our work is about participation and trying to do things in slightly different ways.
And with our iSpy books of Freeze projects stamped, we headed to the bus to see who'd stolen our thermos and lunchbox and take stock of some thoughtful interventions in East London's ordinary, un-Olympic landscape. So that was how some artists responded to the east of London, a place many have made their homes and workplaces. But how about a response to how London has chosen to brand, stage and control the Olympic Park and the Olympic Project? Ian Sinclair, a vehement, vocal and never knowingly under-adjectivised critic of London's endless eastward-bound prettification projects, teamed up with filmmaker Andrew Cotting to make Swandown, which, in its subtle diversionary way, wonders what the Olympics are playing at, spending billions, uprooting thousands, changing the landscape without much thought of that much-vaunted thing, legacy. Sinclair and Cotting decided to set sail on a watery odyssey from Hastings, down on England's south coast, up through the waterways of the southeast to meet the Medway and then the Thames to see how far they could reach into the Olympic Park's innards by boat. What boat? Why, a swan-shaped pedalo, of course, liberated from a pleasure garden pond in Hastings. The film is a travelogue, a fairly reliable narrative of a journey on swanback into the heart of Olympic darkness.
The idea struck us to take a swan, to drag it across the shingle into the sea, and in doing so, to release one of the trapped souls of the seaside, and to take it together on a journey through the sea, across the rivers of Kent to the Thames, and finally to the Olympic site.
Onward and outward.
Onwards and outward.
Onward and outward. Onward and outward.
And outward.
Onward
and
outward.
Onward and outward.
Onward
and outward.
And maybe we together are releasing a single soul, or maybe we ourselves will be sucked into that great dream of the city and disappear.
So you really think that might help?
That'll do.
That's going to do the job.
Onward and outward.
Onward.
Blooded the swan, blooded the man.
Blooded the man and blooded the swan.
The absurdity was to take a plastic swan and pedal it until it became a real swan. And we ourselves would evolve into birds or dead sheep or shitting cows.
Onwards and outwards.
And that transformation would in fact become the essence of the journey.
We always knew that we were going to end our particular journey at the Angel Islington. There's a tunnel there. We knew, having kind of walked the route, that we couldn't really get beyond there. But it also seemed to be incredibly, I guess, symbolic for an ending. It was like entering the underworld and beginning a new journey, which perhaps we will do together. So we've kind of plotted and we knew roughly what we were up against over 3 or 4 years. When eventually we do manage to kind of like bait the oceans and get out into the channel and start heading off towards London, it was kind of easy.
You know, because the territory that I've engaged with and wrestled with altogether is around Hackney in the Lower Lee Valley, which has become enclosed and disappeared and denied to me. The whole argument was to get this swan there as a kind of force of transformation. And ironically, I couldn't do it because I had to leave at the mouth of the River Lee to go to America, which was a prearranged thing I couldn't get out of. So then Andrew is on his own. So it takes on a wonderfully melancholy pilgrimage.
It's just Andrew with his little, the mini swan.
A bag. And mini swan is a familiar, which has been on the journey with us.
Get away from the all the...
It's
all
like a sort of little religious icon you
Sitwell,
take around
known
with you.
To Sitwell. The big swan was called Edith. The small one was called Sitwell, very much in homage to both Edith's swan neck and Edith Sitwell. And I'm kind of peddling through... I guess it's Sinclair's kind of territory. It really is a zone. And
it's like a past narrative, which is something that happens in Downriver as well, because at that point in the Downriver book, I passed the narrative over to a character based on Brian Catling and let him tell the story in his voice. And this time, passed over very successfully to Andrew Cotting. And when it goes into the tunnel and he lets the swan drift away and he dives into the water and starts swimming back towards the camera very slowly, he's fulfilling exactly what we set out to do, was when I asked him to swim round the boundaries of Hackney and he refused. So the thing had come completely full cycle and we got a payoff that I couldn't have even looked for.
And this part of it is nonetheless surprising, but might take people who know your work. They probably expect more of your voice to be on the film, Ian, especially more of your, not necessarily reading from your own work, but interpreting the landscape around you as we the viewers see it.
More of his Kent.
And you do get,
I did it. It's all cut out.
he delivered it. The word showers were coming at me every single day. And even he was wooing me down at the Thames estuary, as he mentioned there, with reading from downriver. But if things got too difficult or certainly too intellectual, I was off. I was straight into the water.
You just got a lot of swimming.
It was safer out of Edith than on board Edith with Ian Sinclair. It really was otherwise. It was an educational bombardment. And there's only so much that a man can take.
Do you get a sort of shipping forecast each day of words that you might be able to encounter?
I became a flesh radio Eden. I mean, Ian became a flesh radio.
Now tell me about the flesh radio, because this is something that I think you mentioned it a few times.
Well, I used the phrase. It's one of the few phrases I was allowed to use that weren't quietly dispensed with, because otherwise it would have got too serious.
This is you channeling, because there's a lot of idea.
I thought that Andrew's thing he does beautifully, which I admired so much from other films, was to pluck this cacophony of voices and sounds and overlaps, sometimes genuine cultural things, sometimes parodic versions. There'd be people pretending to read Beckett, pretending to be Eliot. Then there would really be, and you didn't know the status of any of these noises that get in your head. And I felt that that's what we had become. We were stuck on this boat in our pink skins under the sun. We had become flesh radios. We were just tuning in to these bands of noise as we went through. And I used that phrase, and in the typical Cotting style, he then stole the phrase and began to pump it back like slurry.
Maybe you should patent some flesh radios, get them in the Conrad shop.
We've got one in a gallery as we speak. There's a flesh radio in South London in Dilson Grove, and I recommend all your listeners to pop down and experience that, because Edith is in situ there as well on the altar, and you'll better have a real kind of trawl through some of the backstory, the genesis of the project, and some of Ian's plottings and mappings. This is pre Swandown, and it's a kind of real testament to both our collaboration and a lot of the stuff that makes Ian tick.
And I wanted to ask you about, the as you said, the cacophony of voices. A lot of the people you invite, a few other people on the boat and other people that have a point of view about both of your work and the project itself. Stuart Lee, you describe as writer and clown, or comedian and clown.
Stuart Lee gets some of the best lines,
mate, because you know, Ian Sinclair's obsessed with the Olympics.
Yeah.
He hates the Olympics more than anything.
I read that in his...
He doesn't think anything should be allowed to happen in Hackney without his permission. So this is what this is about, I think.
That's very funny, and it's also true. I do believe that. And this was absolutely spot on. And Alan Moore's strange sense that by putting two people on a peddler, you could rewire the whole Olympic project, and it would be kind of a non-competitive...
it's a nice idea.
...Socratic dialogue, which would be perfect. So the two of those together, and they have a nice relationship, you know, that's established in the way that the thing with Andrew and I was working on the peddler. It was nice to take on these alternate figures who become the Punch and Judy for a change. And then later on, the people who come on have a slightly different role. They're part of the great Cotting family of people who can be suborned to perform, or who just wanted to be there and without knowing whether they'd be in the film or not. Probably they wouldn't, but they wanted to be a witness. They wanted to be a part of the process, and they queued up to get on.
And in that way, just to kind of rewind a little bit to the notion of the flesh radio, Edith became a little bit like a flesh radio magnet. So people, strangers, this is members of the public, were drawn to conversations, drawn to us. They wanted to know what we were doing, why we were doing it. The absurdity of what we were doing became compelling to them. And therefore you get these a myriad of other voices which can then drift in and out of the soundscape, and also gives you all this amazing imagery. There's this one kind of woman who stood next to a kind of dead swan, and suddenly she realises that it's dead and it's been floating around in the river.
The striking thing to me looking at it is unlike earlier films, it has a stillness. It has a real breathing space that the essential heroine of the whole thing is not even the swan, but the kind of landscape and the combination of the swan and the land. There's a lovely shot after a comedy thing where we're entering Rye Harbour and this shore patrol, border patrol boat comes in with all these guys standing. That sets up the moment, but the next frame is just empty and this swan comes in and suddenly that's very funny.
When we get to London, there is a sense of, there's a forlornness. There's a sense that the Olympics is looming. Things are being kind of constrained. We're being prevented. There is a kind of difficulty. There's a sense of things being, the heavy waters of the River Lee are palpable. And then most importantly, I think for me, there was a sense of kind of loneliness and forlornness because Sinclair wasn't next to me. And you know, then I start meditating upon, you know, his having been with me for so long and the loss of him. But then I introduce his voice in a different way through transatlantic phone calls, through radios and through other devices. So he's kind of the ghost of Sinclair lives on.
Sinclair's abroad. He made the flight to Boston and his way across the ocean, confabulating and probably mythologizing. That's what he does.
Ian, you're dressed fairly practically. You're sporting some Gore-Tex and things.
Yeah, sort of a multi-pocketed waistcoat some of the time, and I had to wear these glasses, reflective glasses, so the shots could be got. You know, all that narcissistic stuff, and the hat. So it was all very practical and sort of like a sensible English gentleman, if I was English. And Andrew's got the comedy suit.
He's definitely Welsh.
He's still locked in the sort of Gilbert and George tradition, essentially.
Yes, this suit becomes quite.
It becomes sacred. It's a kind of Boycian suit. And it's on the wall in the chapel now. It's hung up like a holy relic.
It's a uniform. It's a dressing up. And most projects that I've been involved with for probably the last 25 years, there'll always be a costume. And in fact, the suit that I'm wearing now, the swan down suit was modelled on it. But I've annihilated it so much. I mean, I'd like to be sat here today in the same suit, but that stays, as Ian says, in the gallery.
Offers for the suit can be taken in writing, care of the Guggenheim Museum.
It went through some wars. We can probably smell it from Marylebone to
it, yes.
Yeah. For the time being, Andrew Cotting, Ian Sinclair, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Swandown.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and again how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Premiering on Monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Badi Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake. All of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film plus our top 25 most livable city countdown on monocle.com.
Still to come in part two, we shake ourselves free of our Olympic shackles to go on set with Columbia's hit crime drama series, all about the life and legacy behind the lines. It's a series devoted to the world's most notorious drug lord, Pablo Escobar. We'll chat with our musical guests post-war years, and we'll get a 1 minute of sound courtesy of Danny Giacopelli and our most livable city, Zurich. Stay the jolly goodness gracious tune. More music before we get up to our eyes in narcotics, in a radio way. This from post-war years Midori House session is Galapagos. That was Post-War Years singing Galapagos, and this is Simon and Henry from the band who dropped by the studio for a chat before loading their 10 tons of synths, cables and effects boxes into a very big white van.
That was what I think the music press might describe as an incendiary live performance. Thank you for that.
Oh, wow.
I like the way you were sort of arranged on stage, sort of all looking at each other in a sort of like square. How does that work? Is that your normal on-stage formation, or is that your practice?
It's not quite. Yeah, we weren't fully prepared for the audience, to be honest. So we kind of set up beforehand.
Basically, we didn't think there was going to be an audience. So
oh, right. And then we shot you at the last minute.
And then the audience walked in, and we were like, oh dear, we've set up with our backs to you.
We're comfortable now.
Embarrassing.
But it's one of those things, I guess, you set up like that because there's a lot of... You're looking at each other a lot. There's a lot of different rhythms, there's a lot of syncopation and anti-syncopation and all sorts of different stuff going on there, different time signatures. It's complicated stuff. Presumably you need to know what the other guy's doing. You can't sort of have your backs to each other staring out at the audience, can you?
Yeah, I like to think we're reasonably well oiled now, so we don't actually.
Yeah, we've been drilling.
You did allude to drinking gin throughout your set.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate habit, you know.
You know what happens. You know what's going to happen. You're going to end up. You're going to be a single mum. You're going to be in your apartment. It's going to be 10:30 in the morning, and you'll think, "Oh, why not? I've run out of tonic. Yeah, I've got no ice. But why not have a gin?" That's the beginning of the end for rock bands.
It's true.
Mother's ruin.
It's just so stressful playing a band. You know, it really is that it turns you to the gin.
And I want to know how you write this stuff, because it sounds brilliant and it all meshes together, and that's, you know, we heard that live and it sounded fantastic. But that must be quite tough stuff to write. Does that come from kind of riffing off each other, or are you quite structured and you write it all down first?
We generally all start demoing individually on a computer and then kind of build it up, would you say? Just kind of layer things up, kind of get to a stage with the track and then pass it on to the rest of the band and...
Yeah, I think
everyone adds their little bit.
I think we're quite inspired by like the equipment that we use, rather than like a you know, you don't sit down and think, right, I'm going to write a song because I'm feeling sad. It's more like, I've got this cool synth now.
Because there's a lot of boxes and wires. I've never seen so many Midori house for the sessions.
Yeah, it's quite a collection now.
Yeah, it's kind of, unfortunately, I think that stems from the sort of like no limits sort of school of songwriting. Which, you know, sound-wise, like, I kind of think because of how cheap technology is these days, it's kind of really easy to sort of grab an amazing piece of gear for, like, you know, next to no money. So
the kitchen sink, because you can throw in the kitchen sink.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of people have started making, you know, more and more people are starting to make electronic music, and I think that's one of the reasons, because there's no limits, and then you kind of... It's an unfortunate thing sometimes as well, because you literally could make any noise imaginable, you know, and...
And we heard some of them in there.
Yeah.
And how does it work? Because it gives quite a bold sound, especially experimenting with the different effects and the different, you know, kind of the whatever is an 808, the equivalent of an 808 these days. You know, that kind of thing. Being able to squelch those sounds out of those boxes is an amazing thing. And as you say, it's kind of like a bit of a Pandora's box musically. But it gives you presumably quite a bold sound, and then you strap the drums onto that, and it does. Is that is that the signature? Is that sort of, you know, is that where the songs come from, that strict kind of rhythm that the drums give you?
I think it's primarily a...
Rhythm's always been... Yeah, bit of an obsession of ours. I think we're quite fortunate in having Fred as a drummer, because the man's a robot, really. We'll program stuff on a computer beforehand and then send him a beat, and before you know it, he's kind of riffed on through it. He starts really slowly.
He's
and
better than a computer.
He's got it.
He's better than a computer.
He's better than a robot. You called him a robot.
Yeah, and he's just so mechanical. You know, he's like... He literally starts off really slowly, you know, just like...
Why is Fred not in here now? Are you having him, like, oiled? Is he in
he's
the
just,
kind of
yeah,
droid...
He's in his case.
Is he in... Yeah, okay.
he's really quite a creative, you know, big creative part of the band, really. But it's a strange setup, really. It's kind of a weird way that we work, I think. I think primarily we see Post-War Years as, like, an electronic project, but it has...
There's a lot of soul in the way you guys sing, especially when you're singing harmonies and stuff together. There's a lot of harmonies, and obviously it adds a lot of strength to that, because it's such a bedrock of drums and the electronic sort of backing to it. You all sing in harmonies. Is that because you all want to sort of take a slice?
Yeah.
No man must rise to the top. There's no lead singer in our band, man.
It's like a massive democracy, man.
I love that.
I think we were fans of Gomez back in the day.
So I loved it. Yeah.
I thought we'd try and pull that one off.
Yeah, I just think, like... I think we just worked out that all three of us could sing, and we were like, well, why not? I don't know, like, some people get confused by that, I think. Like, I remember like when we first started, like, loads of like A&R dudes coming to the gigs, yeah, or whatever, and being like, whoa, man, you know. One of my friends, anyway, said,
I like that
said
A&R,
to me,
man. He's like from the 70s, me, yeah, in California. Whoa, man.
One of my friends said to me, you know, he's speaking to this A&R guy, and he was just like, oh, like, they've got like three singers. It's just ridiculous. And it's like, well, Beatles, you know?
Well, how does that work? Yeah, exactly. How does that work? You know, do people want to, when people come around and they're scouting and all the rest of it, and you're telling people about what you are, which you, I guess you inevitably have to do, especially more nowadays and in the whoa, man, 1970s.
Yeah.
You have to sort of sell yourself a bit. Does that sort of make it a problem? Do people sort of want to put you in a... Do people want to put you in a little pigeonhole, the music press or
oh, yeah,
A&R people, so that they can sell them to their bosses,
yeah,
their editors?
It's really difficult. I think our EP got reviewed recently.
Yeah,
and it, they, you know, the review was basically like, it's a great EP, it's just, you know, each song is completely kind of different.
It's
and I kind of think, what's wrong with that? You know, what's wrong with...
Yeah.
What's wrong with, you know, as long as you do it well, you know, as long as you don't do like loads of random stuff, and then it all just doesn't make sense and you're rubbish. I don't know. I just think
people get scared of that, maybe, don't they?
Yeah,
they turn up with a ton of stuff, and then they're like, oh god, and they kind of, maybe they judge you on the gear rather than the sound. And tell us what the name of the EP is, because I misannounced it. It was out last week.
Yeah, it's called The Glass House EP.
And we heard the eponymous title track of the EP in the session. Okay, Simon and Henry from Post-War Years, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. We explore the people and products, the buildings and businesses, the signs and cities that make life better. Each week we bring to life the relationship we have with the things that we live with.
Actually, one of my favourite objects is my motorcycle. I love going by motorcycle. I have this Royal Enfield, a classic English motorcycle from the 50s, but it's exactly as it was in the 50s, and I love the shape, the sound of the engine. I love really how it fits in my life.
We sit down with a cast of characters and chew through the issues at stake in the design world today, across manufacturing, craft, fashion, architecture, and graphics.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
The Olympics are coming to London. And to Monocle 24. From the 27th of July and throughout the Games, we'll be going faster, higher and stronger, bringing some of the icons of the Games into Midori House, as well as taking Midori House out on the road with a series of special shows from across the city. Monocle 24, keeping a sporting eye and an ear on the Olympics.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Almost 20 years after Colombia's most notorious drug lord, Pablo Escobar, was gunned down on a rooftop in his native city of Medellin, the life of a man who defined Colombia during the 1980s and early 1990s, and whose legacy can be still felt today, is being relived in a hit television series. Every weeknight, around 11 million Colombians tune in to watch the show Pablo Escobar, The Boss of Evil, tracing the rise and fall of Escobar's cocaine empire. As head of the Medellin drug cartel, Escobar was one of the world's most wanted and richest men, so powerful that he once famously offered to pay off Colombia's foreign debt. Escobar's reign of terror claimed the lives of some 4,000 people, and the country was on the brink of becoming a failed state. The show has broken audience viewing records, but not everyone's thrilled with the portrayal of Escobar. Anastasia Maloney caught up with the show's director and actors on set and asked them why it's important to revisit this dark episode in Colombia's recent history and why the series is sparking debate.
Quieticos y preparados, 3, 2, 1, acción.
As the sun sets on a lavish hilltop country estate, overlooking forested mountains, tall cactuses and lakes, the show's director, Carlos Moreno, prepares for a long night of filming against this spectacular backdrop. The reason behind Escobar's enduring fascination and controversy, says Moreno, is that he's a figure Colombia's poor can identify with.
This is very complex because I think that drug traffic is a kind of social revolution in Colombia. Pablo Escobar is a typical Colombian who wants to be rich and who have the intelligence to do it, And I think that there is a lot of people of working class in Colombia who wants to be rich and who wants to change the society. And if they want that, maybe they see in Pablo Escobar a kind of, I don't know, not hero, but prototype, maybe.
The show uses local actors and outdoor locations, from penthouses in Miami to Colombia's eastern plains and the slums of Medellin, all intertwined with narco slang and old news footage, giving this series an authentic feel that goes against stereotypes.
What is already known in the world about drug traffic and Colombians is maybe guys with full of wash chains, bottle of whiskey, girls with big tits, and this is not drug traffic. Drug traffic is a big enterprise, a big project that moves a lot of money around the world, not only in Colombia, and we are just a part of this business, no? And yes, we are Latin American people, maybe in one context, but we're trying to leave these stereotypes that is not from us.
For Moreno, what's important is that Colombians are telling the story of Escobar.
Yo sé por qué me reclama a mí. Yo soy comandante MR-20. Yo no tengo nada que ver con ellos.
¿Quién fue el que me lo recomendó a mí?
In one corner of the bustling set, the stars show Andrés Parra, who plays Pablo Escobar, sits next to a fan, a respite from the 40-degree heat and hovering mosquitoes. As he rehearses his lines, makeup artists polish up his thick moustache and customised wig. Taking a break from his grueling filming schedule, Parra explains how he prepared for the challenging role.
We were very worried about the wig and about the looking of Pablo, because I don't have that much hair as he did. So it was like a four-month preparation, like reading and trying to get as close as I could to the voices of Escobar.
Parra bears an uncanny resemblance to the villain. There are dozens of extras on set, all trying to get a glimpse of the star who's received rave reviews. The actor Parra recalls growing up during the Escobar era.
As a child, you have like the image of this big monster that is Pablo Escobar, and it's something that you don't want to talk about, that you don't have the permission to ask many questions about, and I think that was the image I had of Escobar in those times.
The actor says he wanted to show Escobar's human side too. Indeed, critics of the television series say Parra has done too good of a job at humanising Escobar.
He's a very good father, he's a very good husband, he's a very good son, he's a very good brother. So the big thing for me was like to mix all these characters, because Escobar has like 1,000 faces.
La única manera que existe de llevar a juicio al señor presidente de la Cruz es obligándolo.
Y es precisamente eso lo que vamos a hacer. Y por eso necesitamos de su ayuda.
There's little doubt about the savage and ruthless nature of Escobar, a man who brought three successive governments to their knees through corruption and intimidation. But the series is also a painful reminder of Colombia's social inequality, a weak police force and judiciary, and self-serving politicians who colluded with Escobar. It's touching a nerve among Colombia's elite, believes Parra.
What I found after the research was that Escobar is like a big leader of social revenge. He is like fighting against the Colombian government, the Colombian aristocracy, the Colombian rich people, like trying to get his part in the world and trying to get into these social circles that he is not able to be just for being poor.
The producers of the show say the aim is to remind Colombians about the heroes who fought Escobar and the thousands of victims he left in his wake. They're in a position to know. The show's producer is Juana Uribe, whose mother was kidnapped for 7 months by Escobar's henchmen. And her co-producer is Camilo Cano, whose father, Guillermo Cano, was a fearless editor of Colombia's newspaper, El Espectador, who exposed Escobar and was killed by his hitman in 1986.
Many people, the young generations, and also the people in the in other countries besides Colombia, they think that Escobar was just a drug dealer. I think, for me, it's very important that this TV show shows to the people that all the other horror that Escobar did in this country.
Such horrors included Escobar orchestrating a commercial plane to be blown up. All 107 passengers on board were killed. There are also weekly car bombs that claim the lives of dozens of innocent bystanders. Escobar's hitmen murdered anyone who got in the drug lord's way, including a justice minister, a presidential candidate, scores of police officers, judges and journalists. Like many of the show's actors, Christian Tapan, who plays Gustavo Gaviria, Escobar's cousin and right-hand man, remembers the unrelenting violence during Escobar's reign.
We all felt the violence and all the things that hit society and the ethics of Colombians at that time. When we were kids, they used to tell us, don't go to the shopping mall because a bomb could go off. Don't go to such and such a place because there could be drug violence. We're interpreting the story of Pablo Escobar, but that doesn't mean it's an apology.
He also hopes lessons about the past can be learnt from the show.
We need to watch the show and be aware about what happened to Colombia in that era and where mistakes were made. The fact that Escobar rose the way he did means that lots of individuals from our Colombian society had to have played a part in the development and rise of this criminal bandit, Pablo Escobar.
There's still a lot to discover about Escobar, and for Colombians to come to terms with, says director Moreno.
There are a lot of things to discover because that was a sad moment of our history. There are open wounds. Time passes, we will find the real story of Pablo Escobar.
That was Anastasia Maloney in Colombia. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Last weekend, Monocle's Danny Giacopelli went on a little Euro trip. He started by getting all action man on us, in the name of business, of course, at the outdoor show in Friedrichshafen, Germany, and then nipped over to Zurich to recover. He witnessed a tightrope competition, he went to a viaduct, he even drank some coffee. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is what it all sounds like.
Rufus seals can be opened anywhere along the strip, while the rest of the strip remains closed.
Okay.
Maintains a seal under extreme flexibility and deformation.
That's what a working trip sounds like to Daniel Giacopelli, and that's all we have time for, folks. Next week, we'll be talking sports commentators, my dear old things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. My producers were Dawn Trump and Holly Fisher and James Bacon too. What a dream team. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Post-War Years with The Bell. Thanks for tuning in.
times. Those days left behind, left a burning dream after years of lullabies. Love is a feeling I choose to believe, and I think that I'm alive. My smile is in danger of giving away, but I'm fine the way I am. Swinging, swinging.
And rap on it.